You've probably seen the headlines, right?
Yeah.
Big political changes in Bangladesh.
Yeah, huge. A government that was there for a long time, Sheikh Hasina's government, it's fallen. And now there's an interim administration.
Exactly. But, headlines only tell you so much. What's actually happening there? What are the real dynamics?
Well, that's what we want to get into.
Okay, let's unpack this because we have some really, really interesting material. It's an in-depth interview Muhammad Yunus gave to Al Jazeera.
And Yunus, I mean, everyone knows him, Nobel laureate, microfinance pioneer. He's actually now the chief advisor to this interim government. So he's right in the middle of it.
Right at the center.
Yeah.
And he calls this moment, get this, a second liberation for Bangladesh.
That's powerful terminology, isn't it? A second liberation. He argues that the last 15 years under Sheikh Hasina, well, they weren't good.
Not good is putting it mildly, based on his words. He talks about corruptions, violations of all norms, even the destruction of all the institutions.
It sounds incredibly bleak.
Yeah, and he uses some really strong language. He actually calls it a fascist regime at one point in the interview. Does he elaborate much on why he uses that specific term? Like, what specific features made him describe it that way?
You know, the excerpt we're focusing on doesn't list specific policy examples for that term, but he absolutely lays out the consequences. He talks about enormous misgovernance. He
Sure.
mentions atrocities, cruel things done to citizens, and a big one, the plundering of the economy, just stripping it bare, essentially.
Wow. So if you put all that together, yeah, it paints a picture of a society just pushed to its limit.
Absolutely. To the breaking point.
And it seems like it was the younger generation, Gen Z, who were really the catalyst here. He talks about a monsoon revolution on August 5th.
Yeah, the monsoon revolution. He says they hit the streets with a very clear message. You have to go. Simple as that.
That's really something. It makes you think about the power of youth movements, doesn't it? Not just there, but globally.
Oh, definitely. Yunus clearly sees their role as absolutely pivotal in making this change happen. Their voice, their action, it just couldn't be ignored anymore.
So, okay, the old government collapses,
Worry.
and Yunus starts talking about this hope for a new Bangladesh.
Right. He contrasts the terrifying reality they just left behind with this chance for a completely fresh start, a chance to fix
But
things.
there must be a worry, right, that the same old faces, the old guard, as he puts it, might just kind of reappear, maybe in a slightly different form.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And Yunus says, yeah, that fear is absolutely real. It's on everyone's mind.
So how do they stop that?
He says the interim government's number one focus, their main job right now, is preventing that exact thing. And the way they're doing it is through massive institutional reform.
Okay, and when you say massive,
15 reform commissions.
16. Wow.
Yeah, each one focused on a specific piece. The Constitution, elections, the civil service, the judiciary, the whole, they're gathering ideas right now.
Okay, 15 commissions, that's ambitious. And they're aiming for this July charter. Have we seen this kind of approach work elsewhere? Getting broad agreement on paper like that, leading to real stability. What are the risks?
Well, the process itself is interesting. They have a specific commission just for building consensus.
Okay.
It takes all the recommendations to the different political parties. He described it almost like using a spreadsheet, figuring out point by point where everyone can agree.
A spreadsheet approach to nation building, huh?
Kind of, yeah. The whole idea is to build this common ground first on the really crucial stuff. Because, if a big groups feel left out, that's a recipe for instability down the line.
Makes sense. So this consensus document, the July Charter, named after the uprising month,
Yeah.
that becomes the roadmap.
That's the plan. Some reforms implemented before elections, some maybe after. But it sets the direction. It's trying to be very methodical.
And Gen Z, the ones who started this monsoon revolution, are they involved in shaping this charter?
Yes, he specifically mentions that. Their new political party is part of this consensus-building effort, too, recognizing, the huge role they played.
Okay, so looking ahead, future leadership. Is Yunus backing anyone specific or pushing for a certain type of leader?
Not really pushing for a person. His focus is much more on moving away from, well, again, he uses that strong term, fascist regime, to describe the previous setup.
Right.
But the priority isn't finding the perfect leader. It's fixing the system, reforming the institutions, the policies. That's the core idea.
So the July Charter is meant to set the rules of the game, basically.
Exactly. Establish the norms, the standards, so that whoever does come to power, they're held accountable to these principles that everyone hopefully agreed on. It's less about trusting one person's character.
Right, more about trusting the framework. Yeah. Okay, so elections. What's the time frame?
He mentioned a window. The earliest possibility might be December this year.
Okay.
The latest, maybe next June.
That's quite a range.
Yeah.
What determines whether it's sooner or later?
It really depends on how much agreement they actually get on all these reforms.
The consensus building.
Yeah. And then deciding how many of those agreed reforms need to be put in place before people go to vote. But they're committed, he says, to making it the best election ever taken place in Bangladesh.
High bar.
A very high bar. They're even promising to allow international observers. Full transparency.
What about the Awami League? Sheikh Hasina's party? Are they expected to participate in this election?
Yunus says, look, that's up to them. The party has to decide.
And if they do or don't?
Then the election commission has to react to that decision. And you might get challenges from other parties, too, based on, you know, existing laws about who can participate. It just shows how tricky the political path ahead really is.
Yeah, definitely sounds like navigating a minefield. So getting everyone on board for elections is one challenge. What else is this interim government up against right now?
Well, he's realistic. Mm. He admits the honeymoon period, if there ever was one, is probably over. People want answers, concrete results.
Understandable.
And there are big lurking issues. That lingering influence of the old guard. We talked about the risk that they could exploit any political vacuum.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the huge ongoing situation with the Rohingya refugees. Roughly 1 million people.
That's an immense challenge on its own. How are they approaching the Rohingya crisis?
Yunus says they're handling it with the UN, with international organizations, but he's quite firm on the point that while Bangladesh stepped up and gave shelter initially.
Which is huge.
Absolutely. But he believes the ultimate responsibility for their well-being and, crucially, their safe return to Myanmar lies with the global community.
So pushing for international action.
Yes. Diplomatic efforts to facilitate return. He acknowledges some donors might cut funding, but he seems optimistic that other countries will continue to provide aid.
That optimism is interesting. I wonder, are there independent reports backing that up? That the international community is ready to fill potential funding gaps? Because the consequences, if that support doesn't come through, could be pretty severe.
That's a fair question and something to watch. But beyond the immediate crises, there's the past. What about accountability for what happened under Sheikh Hasina?
Yeah, that seems critical for a new Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Yunus mentioned killings, disappearances.
He pledges justice for those people. He points out there's already a UN-led investigation. They've published a detailed report outlining these issues. It really is sobering stuff.
Absolutely. It highlights why people were demanding change so fiercely.
And Yunus insists the legal system is now functioning independently. Trials for perpetrators are expected to start soon.
Does that include everyone? Even powerful figures?
He makes a very strong statement. Nobody will be spared. That includes military officials, intelligence officials, if they're found to have committed crimes against humanity.
That's a bold promise. Then there's the corruption he mentioned earlier, the plundering.
Yes, yeah, staggering amounts, apparently. He references that UN report again, but gives specific examples, too, like the banking system being, quote, completely emptied out. He described bank boards being taken over under gunpoint, then massive loans given out to allies with absolutely no intention of ever paying them back. Just siphoned off.
Unbelievable.
The scale sounds enormous. He says there are ongoing investigations trying to track down stolen assets hidden overseas Europe, the Caribbean, Asia, and they're actively trying to recover the money.
Are other countries helping with it? Asset recovery?
He says they are getting cooperation from foreign governments, yes.
Which brings us to specific cases, like Tulip Siddiq. She's Sheikh Hasina's niece, right? And a British MP. There's an arrest warrant for her.
Yes, related to alleged family corruption. She denies it all, of course.
So how does Yunus frame that? Is it political targeting?
He frames it as being based on concrete evidence. He emphasizes it's now for the legal system to decide if the case holds water. It's not about immediate arrest, he says, but about the Anti-Corruption Commission bringing the case, and then potentially courts deciding on extradition from the UK.
Okay. And then there's Sheikh Hasina herself. She's currently in India.
Yes. And apparently she's still claiming to be the rightful prime minister, making statements from New Delhi.
That must be awkward, diplomatically speaking.
Extremely. Yunus actually talked about meeting Indian Prime Minister Modi in Bangkok recently.
Oh, what happened?
Yunus asked Modi if India could request that she stop making these inciting speeches from Indian soil.
And Modi's response?
According to Yunus, Modi basically said India has a very open social media environment and he couldn't really control what she says.
Sounds like a polite no.
Pretty much. Yunus also mentioned Bangladesh sent a formal letter to the Indian government asking for her return, but they haven't received a response.
So Bangladesh is kind of on its own to resolve that situation.
It seems that way. It highlights the tricky relationship dynamics.
Okay, let's broaden out from the immediate fallout. What about Yunus's vision for Bangladesh's place in the world, the foreign policy piece?
Well, he's been busy. He mentioned visiting China, Thailand. That was for a BIMSTEC meeting.
Right, BIMSTEC Bay of Bengal Initiative for Multisectoral Technical and Economic Cooperation, for our listeners. And SARC is the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, key regional groups.
Exactly. He's also planning a trip to Malaysia. Interestingly, he said they tried to arrange a visit to India, but didn't get a response yet.
That cold shoulder again.
Seems like it. But he's pushing regional cooperation, trying to revive SARC, strengthen BIMSTEC. He even mentioned wanting Bangladesh to get associated with ASEAN eventually.
So looking outwards.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship with India.
He characterized it as maybe a temporary cold shoulder, but stressed that friendship is important and it needs resolving. Interestingly, he also sounded quite positive about relations with the Trump administration in the U.S. Said U.S. tariffs weren't specifically targeting Bangladesh, just global policy.
Okay. Now, beyond politics and foreign policy, Yunus is famous for his economic thinking, microfinance. Has this experience shifted his broader views, especially on things like capitalism?
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like it's deepened his critique. He suggested that our current civilization, based purely on profit and greed, is fundamentally self-destructive.
Strong words. So what's the alternative?
He's advocating for what he calls a new civilization, one driven more by social consciousness. He talks a lot about social businesses.
Explain that concept a bit.
These are businesses designed specifically to solve a social problem: poverty, healthcare, environment, whatever it is. They operate like a business, they aim to be sustainable, cover costs. But the key difference is there's no personal profit for the owners or investors.
So any profit gets reinvested.
Exactly. Reinvested back into the business to expand its impact, solve the problem better. It exists alongside traditional profit-maximizing businesses offering another way.
Where did these ideas come from originally for him?
He often traces it back to the terrible famine in Bangladesh in 1974. Seeing that level of suffering made him question the whole economic system. He fundamentally believes poverty isn't something inherent in people,
but created by the system.
Precisely. He uses this powerful analogy of a bonsai tree.
A little stunted tree?
Yeah. It looks perfect, miniature, but it's been deliberately constrained. Its pod is too small. Its roots are trimmed. He says that's what our current job-driven economy does to people. It limits their potential.
Because he sees people as naturally
creative, entrepreneurial even. But the system, especially the financial system, often prevents them from expressing that.
So bringing this back to the interim government's plans, they need IMF support, right? There are economic reforms needed. How does that square with this philosophy? Will the poorest be hit hardest by reforms?
He insists they won't be. He says the commitment is that reforms will not further burden the poorest. The ultimate goal, he says, is to build an economy where Bangladesh is self-sufficient.
How?
By unleashing the energy of the population. He points to Bangladesh's huge demographic advantage. It's a young country. Half the population is under 27. They're tech-savvy, engaged.
That is a massive potential resource.
Huge. He also mentioned how the July uprising itself was incredibly unifying. It brought people together, all ages, locations, genders. It happened fast, everywhere. A shared sense of purpose.
But there are still deep-seated problems. What about labor issues? We hear reports about abuses in factories, especially subcontracted ones. Microfinance didn't solve everything.
No, and he acknowledges that. He's clear. Microcredit isn't a magic bullet for every problem. His core belief remains that people are born entrepreneurs, but the financial system holds them back.
So is the interim government planning to tackle those labor issues specifically?
He says yes. There's a commitment to solving them, and specifically to working towards signing the relevant ILO convention, the International Labor Standards. That indicates a serious intent.
It's quite something, isn't it? Yunus himself, he's 84 now, taking on this massive role at this stage in his life.
It really is. He actually recounted how he initially said no when asked to leave the interim government right after Sheikh Hasina fell.
Oh, he turned it down at first.
Yeah. But he said the persistence of the young people, their sacrifices, their urging, that's what convinced him to accept on August 8th.
Wow.
He describes it as a tremendous responsibility, but also, you know, a great opportunity. He genuinely seems to see this as a clean slate moment for Bangladesh, a rare chance.
And his immediate focus now.
Hold peaceful, fair elections. Get the procedures right. Hand over power smoothly to a newly elected government, but do it in a way that builds public trust and satisfaction in the process itself.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. We've covered a lot. The fall of a regime that was there for 15 years.
Driven by this incredible youth movement, the Monsoon Revolution.
And now, this ambitious, complex reform agenda spearheaded by, of all people, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate.
Yeah, but as we've discussed, the path ahead is anything but clear. Huge challenges, overcoming the legacy of the past, those tricky regional relationships, actually implementing lasting change.
It's going to be incredibly difficult, no guarantees.
None at all. But Yunus's core message, that underlying philosophy about needing systemic change, about focusing on social consciousness to unlock what people can really do, that's a powerful driving force.
It really is. And maybe that leaves us and you listening with something to think about.
Yeah.
This idea, Yunus uses the bonsai economy, a system that looks neat, controlled, maybe even efficient on the surface, but is actually stunting growth, limiting potential.
Right, like the bonsai tree.
Exactly. So the thought to leave you with is, what aspects of our own systems, our economies, our societies, maybe even our workplaces might look okay, might seem perfectly structured, but could actually be unintentionally holding us back, holding back broader flourishing, real innovation? Where are our own bonsai pots?
That's definitely something to mull over. A really interesting question.